This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. There are neighborhoods in cities across America that had evolved into wonderful communities where working class and middle class families lived, ate, and shopped, where there was racial diversity, a flourishing culture, and neighborhood cohesiveness. But when such areas were, quote, discovered by wealthier, whiter families looking for the perfect living environment, a slow-moving process of change began, leaving homogeneity in its wake and a destruction of the complex and intangible things that were positive in the first place. The phenomenon is so widespread now that there is a name for it: gentrification. Activists have denounced gentrification as a form of urban colonialism. But the forces driving gentrification are not as clear-cut as historical colonizers. Exploring the myriad forces that feed gentrification in a new book is my guest, Peter Moskowitz. He is a freelance journalist who's written for The Guardian, The New York Times, New Republic, Wired, Slate, BuzzFeed, and more. He's a former staff writer at Al Jazeera America, and he joins me now to discuss his book, How to Kill a City: Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So first, you open your book talking about how you have been on both sides of the fight over gentrification in New York, starting out in the West Village, where your family was part of a community that was essentially erased, and then yourself, looking for affordable places to live, found yourself on the other side of gentrification, being inadvertently a part of the process.
Right.
So how important is New York as an example of, and neighborhoods in New York and specific areas in New York as examples of like ground zero where gentrification has taken place?
Sure. So as you said, yeah, it's had this long history of people kind of being pushed out from neighborhood to neighborhood. Not to give my parents too much flack, but in a way they were kind of part of the first wave of gentrifiers. They bought into this loft building that had been converted from a warehouse. And gentrification was a much different thing then. It was much more based on middle class, usually people moving into oftentimes abandoned buildings. It still, you know, in my view, wasn't without its problems, but it's not what you're seeing today, where neighborhoods are whole scale being redeveloped by real estate developers and the politicians that support them. But nonetheless, you know, the gentrification and the hyper gentrification of their neighborhood ended up pushing people like me, people who make middle class salaries, further and further out until, you know, I was living in neighborhoods in Brooklyn where I did find myself, you know, in the same position that I felt I was in back in the West Village, you know, people giving me the same kind of glare that I'd give the new neighbors of the West Village. And I just got really interested in that process. And New York, as it turns out, is kind of at the forefront of that process. They were the playbook for how to essentially gentrify a city, starting with the city's near bankruptcy in the 1970s. Politicians and real estate developers essentially got together and said, how do we turn New York from an industrial working class city into one almost completely based on real estate wealth? And so they say, you know, from their perspective, it's been tremendously successful. That they've transformed New York into this place where apartments regularly go for $10 million, and you know, the city's coffers are flush because of that. And so when you look at other cities like Detroit or New Orleans, they've really looked to New York as an example for how to run their cities now.
And I definitely want to talk about the ways in which near bankrupt cities are sort of the perfect places for gentrification. But before we go into that, describe mm-hmm. for us what happened to the West Village. Because for those people who haven't seen gentrification firsthand, either happening in their own neighborhood or near them, it's not that clear. It's a slow moving disaster, right? It's something that you almost don't notice. You notice it most dramatically when you visit a city that's been gentrified years later, and you can see the before and after. So what did, how did the West Village change? If you can give us some examples of the kinds of things that were there before that aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the least talked about aspects of gentrification is that it's not only an erasure of a neighborhood. It's an erasure of memory. When I walk through the West Village, I have a very different kind of mental geography of what it's supposed to look like than someone who just moved there, who, you know, or who might go to brunch there and think, wow, what a cute neighborhood filled with brownstones. To be frank, it's kind of depressing for me to walk through it. When I was growing up there, there was a very active queer scene, mostly queer people of color, on Christopher Street, which is 3 blocks away from my parents' apartment. And I'm queer, and you know, I immensely appreciated kind of growing up on the periphery of that. The piers, which are right across from my parents' house and look out onto the Hudson River, you know, is where the you know, famous documentary Paris is Burning was filmed about voguing in the LGBT scene. You know, Bleecker Street was filled with antique shops, many of them owned by recent immigrants. The village was filled with artists, and you know, it was one of the centers that, you know, this is before my time obviously, but you know, back in the 50s and 60s, it was one of the centers for the Beats. It was a place James Baldwin would frequent. It was kind of seen as an inspirational neighborhood for artists, and now it's essentially a mall for billionaires. A string of Marc Jacobs stores has replaced most of the antique stores on Bleecker Street. The pier has been turned over from city control to a private entity that shuts it down at night and uses a private police force to police it. And instead of queer people voguing, you see lots of people jogging with $300 baby strollers. So yeah. It's a very different neighborhood.
Wow. So, you know, the problem, of course, is that gentrification is not a new thing. Gentrification, as you pointed out earlier, is something that has happened. I mean, that's the evolution of neighborhoods. I think the problem is that when you have the building up of a community over many years, sometimes generations, to where a neighborhood becomes this wonderful place to live for those people who have lived there, generations who have made it what it is, and then it becomes attractive for outsiders. Those outsiders looking for that perfect place to live end up displacing the very people that made it great in the first place. And suddenly the gentrification, the forces of gentrification transform it into something that it wasn't and into the kind of place that now people wouldn't want to live in, right? I mean, it's just so ironic.
Yeah, exactly. And Jane Jacobs, the great urbanist and journalist who also lived in the West Village and wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which is probably the most famous book about cities ever written, you know, had this example of a family loving to picnic on this hill so much that they decided to build a house on top of it so they could picnic there all the time, except once they occupied the house, they realized they could no longer see the hill. So I think that's like a good parable about gentrification. Yeah, I do think gentrification is not necessarily a natural process. As much as it is about people desiring neighborhoods, it does have this long legacy of housing inequality and housing-based racism attached to it. A lot of the reason that the people from the suburbs who now desire neighborhoods in the city can afford to move there is because the federal government, after the Great Depression, essentially gifted them houses in the form of mortgage-backed or insurance-backed mortgages. I'm not sure if you've heard of the term redlining before, but that was essentially when the government drew lines around neighborhoods that had majority people of color in them and said, you're not allowed to get mortgages. So that history of housing wealth and the disparity in housing wealth essentially allows a certain group of people, i.e. mostly white people, to move into these neighborhoods and remake them as they see fit.
Right. I mean, absolutely. There, you know, it is definitely, there are some very clear-cut issues you can point to, even if it's a slow-moving evolution of a city. Well, one of the patterns that emerges is that you see the disasters facing cities as being the perfect sort of grounds from whose ashes gentrification can rear, gentrifiers can come in. New Orleans and Detroit are two examples that you write about at length in your book. These are both cities, you know, New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina and the destruction, the physical destruction of that, Detroit with its bankruptcy and the economic destruction of that city. How does the sort of, Naomi Klein's shock doctrine type phenomenon apply in cities like that, that developers see it as the perfect place to rebuild, quote unquote, rebuild, but for different people than those who lived there.
So I think you have to go back a little bit to how city governments have been systemically disinvested from at the federal level. As I'm sure you know, the tax rates for the highest earning people in the United States are several times lower than they were even 30 years ago and 50 years ago. At one point, the tax rate, the top tax rate, income tax rate in the U.S. was 90%. So what that's done is essentially defund cities, and all they need to fund, like public transportation, roads, schools, the list goes on. And they've essentially had to self-fund. So when you look at a city that has a lot of low-income residents, like New Orleans or Detroit, what cities have decided to do is attract more rich people to them in order to essentially self-fund their government. Detroit's economic czar, right after the bankruptcy, literally said at a community forum, "We need more gentrification. We need more white people coming here. We need more rich people coming here because we can't fund the city otherwise." And in New Orleans, there was a very deliberate attempt to not only attract rich people, but to keep out poor people, and specifically poor Black people. After Katrina, Governor Kathleen Blanco at the time said it took the storm of a lifetime to create the opportunity of a lifetime. And they went about dismantling the union, which was a bastion for Black middle class jobs, the school union, sorry. And they privatized the school system. They demolished all public housing, every single public housing unit, and turned them over to private developers to become mixed income communities. So from a bookkeeping standpoint, New Orleans is now better off than it was before the storm. And that's because literally poor people have not been allowed to come back to the city.
And from the other perspective of what made those cities amazing in the first place, the culture and the neighborhoods, what happened to those people that once lived there that can now no longer afford to live there because the wealthier folks whose taxes fund the city have taken their place? Where did they go?
And I can see why people want to live in these cities. When I was living in New Orleans doing reporting for this book, I fell in love with it. It's an amazing place. But what the process has done is essentially forced the people who make the city an amazing place, the musicians, the artists, the people who clean all the hotel rooms that you need to stay in when you're there for Mardi Gras, they're forced to move to places like New Orleans East or Metairie, which are these sprawling suburbs where you can't have a cookout, you can't have a second line, you can't have a block party, which are all things that make New Orleans New Orleans, because you live in these little boxes, that are few and far between, and your only kind of central location is a mall. So essentially, the geography of inequality has been switched, so that poor people are now increasingly forced to live in these suburban communities, where things that they relied upon in cities, especially community, is really hard to come by.
And those neighborhoods that are sort of seen as targets for gentrification, one of the things that's so important about them, and you point this out in your book, is their cohesiveness, that these are often self-reliant communities where people have spent decades building up institutions and infrastructure that make it a perfect living space, that neighbors look out for one another, they know one another, so they police, they parent help parent each other's children. That sort of intangible glue gets lost too.
And that's something that Jane Jacobs talks a lot about in Death and Life, and I talk about in my book too. When I was a kid, I would walk to school. It was about 10 blocks away when I was starting from when I was 10 years old, because I knew people on the block. I had friends to walk with to school with. If my mom was late to pick me up, I could, go hang out with Ernie, the friendly sandwich guy down the block or at the pizza place. It was a cohesive community where people were kind of looking out for each other. Now, when you look at this new style of city development, If you go to any city, you're bound to see, a glass-clad 20-story tall box of a building that has a gym in it and a swimming pool and a high-tech security system, essentially these gated communities within cities. And what that does, not only does that directly mess with the kind of fabric of a neighborhood, but I think it's a sign of what gentrifiers are looking for. They don't want a place where they're part of a community. They want a place where they're essentially in the suburbs, but in the city. And you can see the effect that has. When I look at the West Village now, I don't see kids walking around at all. The only people I see are people who are there to consume things. The only kids I do see are getting into, taxi cabs in the morning to go to their schools in different neighborhoods. So the urban fabric has been kind of ripped apart.
We talked about New York, we talked about Detroit, New Orleans. Let's talk about San Francisco, and in particular, how the tech industry and the sort of spillover from Silicon Valley has really changed the fabric of the city. And I also should say, it's also one of the places where the anti-gentrification movement has been very strong. How have San Francisco neighborhoods suffered from gentrification, and has the pushback had any success?
So San Francisco, I would say, is the most highly gentrified city in the United States right now. Rents for one-bedroom apartments regularly exceed $3,500 a month. And a lot of the problem is that because the housing stock is owned by kind of small-time landlords, they can get away with things, like converting a low-income property, a three-story house, let's say, into luxury condos. And people might not know their rights in the same way as, if you try to displace a building of 1,000 people, it's going to cause a much bigger scene than if you slowly displace building after building after building. So that's a big problem. And another big problem is that the city keeps courting tech investment, even as it's clear that that investment is kind of helping ruin the city. One of the politicians of San Francisco did an estimate and found that the city would have something like a $19 billion surplus by 2020 because of how much investment is there. Yet they're giving tax breaks away still to tech companies like Twitter. With the theory that if they don't, the city is not going to be able to economically function.
And that's this
But
whole
as
idea, this defunct idea of trickle-down economics comes into play there.
And it, yeah, it would be, and I think, I think essentially it's this idea more than it is a reality, because it would be one thing if San Francisco was Detroit and they looked around and they said, wait, there are no jobs here. But there are too many jobs in San Francisco. There are too many jobs per housing units. Something like 30% of Bay Area residents have thought about leaving in the last year because of housing prices. And yet, because of this mentality that politicians can't get out of, they think the solution to that is more of the same. But as you said, there is this really amazing movement against gentrification there, and I think its success is built a lot on its intersectionality. There's one organization, Causa Justa, Just Cause, which works with low-income communities from San Francisco to Oakland, out into like the exurbs, where a lot of poor people are being forced to move. But I think what makes them so successful in kind of gathering momentum is that they're not just focused on, bring rent down, or they're not just focused on pass this one bill. They're focused on gentrification is a sign of colonialism. Gentrification is a sign of racism. It's intimately linked to the police shootings that happen in San Francisco in these gentrifying neighborhoods. All these issues are completely linked together. And I think recognizing that is the first step to kind of fighting it.
And so let's talk about that a little bit more. Here in Southern California, where our program is based, there has been also a vibrant anti-gentrification movement in East LA, in particular Boyle Heights. There's a very confrontational group of activists who have literally run out developers and, hipster art galleries, etc. And, it's easy. The developers are easy targets. I mean, in my own neighborhood, I get angry when I, see the same name of the in the name of the same real estate agent popping up and flipping houses, and I want to hate that one person. However, how what are the just from your studying of the situation, what are the best ways to really address the issue of gentrification that are effective. It seems as though we really do need to address how cities and city governments operate, right?
First of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with hating that one real estate. but I do think it is a larger problem. And, you know, we're facing down decades of neoliberal housing policy, of neoliberal economics, of the concentration of wealth, you know, into the hands of the 1%.
And just to pause for a minute, gentrification really is a symptom of income inequality too, right? I mean, we really need to acknowledge that. If we didn't have such huge income inequality in the United States, we wouldn't have such shocking examples of gentrification.
Right. I mean, if you, Black neighborhood, could afford to own the house, the real estate in the neighborhood, then, you know, they would have more autonomy over whether to sell it in the first place. So not that there's an exact formula, but kind of like inequality plus globalization plus urbanism equals gentrification. So you're seeing the level of wealth inequality increase, and you're seeing, because of how globalized the world is, people seeking real estate as an investment, especially in bigger cities like New York and San Francisco. So it's this massive problem. And I don't want to be, you know, too pessimistic, but I think we're just at the beginning of a fight against it. I don't think there's one policy solution or even 10 policy solutions to fight gentrification. I think this is essentially a really important part that's not talked about enough of the global fight against global capitalism.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing some of these stories from your book. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
My guest is Peter Moskowitz. He is a freelance journalist who's written for The Guardian, New York Times, New Republic, and many others. And he's also a former staff writer at Al Jazeera America. We've been talking about his new book, How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.